Chapter 9. Personalities. Every dog is different, but some dogs are more different than others. I am writing this 10 minutes after Luke almost died. I'm overwhelmed with the agony of what almost happened and the relief that it didn't. I can barely type right now. My fingers are stiff and I'm starting to shake. I cannot bear the thought of Luke's dying, and the knowledge that he nearly died a tragic death just a few minutes ago has stunned me as if I'd been slammed into a wall. My neighbors brought Luke home after finding him in the road, about a quarter of a mile away from the farm, walking in the center of the right lane of the county highway that runs by my farm. He was on top of a steep hill that comes right after a sharp curve. The speed limit is 55, but people are people, and many of my neighbors go a lot faster. Visibility is poor on this section of the road, and 4 or 5 times a year, people hit deer there and then knock on my door at 2 in the morning to call the sheriff while I peer out the window behind the deep barks of Luke and Tulip. On this particular morning, the road was especially busy, the usual morning traffic dodging a parade of gravel trucks that roared back and forth to a construction site. Luke is 11 years old. Neither he nor any of my other border collies has ever been in the road in his life. I could leave Luke, Lassie, or Pip outside loose for hours, although I don't, and they would curl up on the porch. They've been carefully trained to stay away from the road, and because of their training and their personalities, they haven't set a paw in it. Deer can rush out of my garden and tear across the road with their white tails flashing, and even if the dogs are in hot pursuit, they'll stop at the road. They ignore bicyclists, joggers, and cars, although they barked big-eyed once when a horse and rider went by. Even Tulip will stay away from the road. It admittedly took me years to train her. She is a Great Pyrenees designed to work independently, and a particularly headstrong one at that. But as long as I'm out with her, Tulip will stop at the edge of the road, even if she's chasing a deer. But I'd never leave Tulip loose outside alone, because she would eventually go on a wander, and it's simply not worth the risk. Unlike Great Pyrenees, Border Collies come from a long line of farm dogs who stay by the farmhouse waiting to do the chores. Until this morning, when, as best as I can tell, Luke ran away from home. As usual, Luke and the other Border Collies had been outside, where I let them out every morning to potty before we go down to the barn to tend to the sheep. I was on the phone to the office when a crew of workers drove up to complete the job of ripping off my roof and replacing it with a new one. It's a horrible project, dirty and noisy, and all of us were suffering from it. Listening to 8 hours of pounding every day is bad enough, but it's particularly disorienting when it comes from the very cover over your den. To make matters worse, we were having a hateful heat wave, with the temperature and humidity both in the high 90s. It was so bad that one of my lambs had died of the heat, so I couldn't possibly have left the dogs in the car or in the barn. With few alternatives, I decided to try to work at home and see if we could all manage. When the pounding started, I threw the ball for the dogs to jolly them up and gave them toys stuffed with treats. They clearly didn't like the noise, but they seemed less concerned than I thought they'd be. Luke and Pip were perhaps a bit clingier and a little quicker to alert to sounds at night, but during the daytime onslaught, they'd settle down by my feet. I thought Luke was managing. I was wrong, and it almost killed him. Luke must have left the yard when the roofers arrived to resume their pounding. I had gotten on the phone when my neighbors, John and Connie Mudor, appeared with Luke a few minutes later. It's a miracle that he wasn't killed. I've never seen the road so busy. I love all my dogs so much that it hurts sometimes. But as much as I love each of them, it is different with Luke. I fell in love with Luke right after I got him, and am still hopelessly in love with him now. Luke is that one-in-a-million dog that most people never get, even dog trainers and breeders who've known hundreds of dogs. Every once in a while, someone will come up to me in a seminar and start talking about their Luke equivalent, a dog who is so special that they can't talk about him without getting tears in their eyes. Maybe you had one once, too, a dog full of such goodness that your heart swells within your chest when you think of him. Maybe you have one now. I hope so. Lucky us. Luke is as handsome a dog as I've ever met, but I've worked with too many dogs who were gorgeous but troublesome to care much about looks anymore. Luke looks like handsome Rhett Butler in Gone with the Wind, but he acts like Ashley. Good, kind, ethical Ashley, the one whom Scarlett would have married if she'd had an IQ larger than her waist size. Luke is noble, pure, and simple. He adores people, but rather than barreling them over with his enthusiasm, he goes over and sits beside them as if respectfully pleased to be in their company. Luke is Zen Dog, always in the present, always exuding what seems like a spiritual kind of peace, the Dalai Lama of dogs. Luke is gracious to other dogs and unfailingly polite to children. He's a brilliant sheep-herding dog, athletic, dedicated, and smart. He has great sheep sense, and he knows far better than I what the sheep are about to do, long before they do it. It's Luke whom I count on to get the market lambs into the truck. It's Luke whom I always took with me when I went into the pasture where the aggressive ram lived. And it's Luke who risked his own life one day, and in the process, might have saved mine. I had gotten trapped in the corner of the barn by Colleen, a crazed, horned ewe, who seemed hell-bent on killing me. A grumpy Scottish blackface ewe, Colleen had just delivered a lamb, and I'd gone in to give her grain and fresh water. But her maternal protectiveness turned into a red-eyed rage, and she lowered her head and tried repeatedly to ram me into the cement wall like some huge, woolly Green Bay Packer. With each charge, I'd dodge to the side, and she'd slam into the wall instead of into me. With each impact, the barn shook, pieces of paint drifting down from the rafters. I grabbed a loose board and slammed it across her head and horns when she came for me the next time, hoping to back her off so that I could make it to the gate. It broke across her thick, bony skull, sending shockwaves up into my shoulders. She didn't seem to notice. I don't think there's much she would have noticed. This was not a calculated attack. Colleen had lost it. She was in the same version of rage that I see in aggressive dogs who are completely out of control. Wild-eyed, Colleen continued ramming toward me and slamming into the wall, paint chips flying, me dodging left, then right. My irritation changed to fear as my legs got tired and my knees began to shake. It seemed absurd that I couldn't get out. I work with aggressive dogs, big ones and little ones, dogs who have hurt people and who want to hurt me. I've had dogs of every description go after me in my office, teeth bared, eyes round and hard. I've had sheep for years, including a ram I'd named Beavis, but should have named Butthead, who was so aggressive that he sent a 6-foot-3-inch friend 10 feet through the air. But this was different. I couldn't get an edge in this game, and I couldn't get out of it. Colleen, armed with her full set of horns, had trapped me in the corner, tired and alone on a farm in the middle of nowhere. It was Saturday morning, and I wasn't due back to work until Monday morning. It'd be a long time waiting for help if I was badly hurt. I was supposed to spend the morning enjoying the chores and smiling at lambs, not trapped with some crazed ewe from hell who was trying to kill me. She finally got me, a hard, painful rip into my right thigh. I remember the entire incident as being strangely silent, except for the thudding impact of each of Colleen's blows. Perhaps that is why the sound of Luke's paws hitting the top of the wooden stall are as clear in my mind today as if I had just heard it. Thwap! Luke's front paws slapped on top of the wooden walls of the stall, and before I could think, he darted between me and Colleen, a blurry streak of black and white headed like a bullet toward her head. Colleen turned toward him, nose still tucked toward her tail, so that her whole head faced backward, and only the bony area between her horns faced toward him. Now she was trying to smash Luke into the wall instead of me. Luke weighs 48 pounds, and if she'd gotten him against the cement wall, she could have killed him in one blow. But Luke is lightning fast, and far more capable of handling an aggressive animal than I could ever be. And soon he and I both maneuvered across the pen to the gate, where we fled to safety. We collapsed together in the straw of the barn, both of us panting and gulping air. Luke's sides heaved, and the corners of his mouth grimaced from a lack of oxygen. Blood was pouring from his mouth where two of his teeth had broken off at the gum line. It began to dawn on me then that by jumping into the pen, Luke had risked his life. I am sure that he knew the danger of what he did. Luke had had years of experience with sheep, and herding dogs learn fast what situations are and aren't dangerous. Luke has been rolled under pounding hooves and pressed against walls enough times to understand the physics of sheep herding. He has never once acted in a way that suggested that he was afraid of being hurt. That's not because he's a border collie. It's because he's Luke. Pip is a border collie too, but Pip wouldn't have taken on Colleen, not in exchange for steak dinners for the rest of her life. She's terrified of physical pain and considers having her nails trimmed to be the ultimate in heroism. Luke's daughter, Lassie, would have taken on Colleen, although I think she'd have been truly scared, and I doubt that she could have generated the force and determination that her father showed that morning. If Tulip had been there, she'd have charged in like an angry mama bear. I'm sure of that because she did once, when Beavis the ram had me smashed between the ground and a fence and wouldn't stop even while Luke repeatedly attacked his head. Tulip roared in like a train, bark growling, teeth flashing, and the ram reared back like a frightened horse and trotted away. Gentle as she is, Tulip won't let anything attack anything else, and she can switch into full warrior mode faster than you can blink. But even given Tulip's peacekeeping tendencies and Lassie's desire to do what's right, I don't think that any of my dogs, except Luke, would have taken it upon themselves to scramble over a 4.5-foot-high wooden wall to jump into the fray. Luke isn't perfect, but you can almost hear the sound of the cavalry when he thinks you need help. Maybe that's why I love him so much. Because I feel as if I can count on him to take care of me. Maybe not. Maybe that's just the kind of explanation that we make up after the fact to try to make sense of our feelings. In some ways, it doesn't really matter why I love Luke in a way that I've never loved another dog. I just do. And since the incident in the barn years ago, my love for him has continued to grow. He's my soulmate dog. And if you asked me today to list my 3 best friends in the whole world, his name is on the list. I'll be grateful for the rest of my life that he didn't die needlessly on the road this morning, when I was reminded once again how every dog is unique and how deep the love can be between a human and a dog. Every dog is different. My love for each of my dogs is different because each dog is different. Every one of my dogs has a unique set of strengths and weaknesses, just like every one of my 2-legged friends. We call it personality, meaning the suite of psychological and behavioral characteristics that uniquely defines each of us. But ascribing personalities to non-human animals is radical to some, who still cling to a mechanistic vision of animals as stimulus-response machines. I was appalled to receive an email last year from a university student who said that her philosophy professor had told the class that animals were incapable of feeling, thinking, and learning. He suggested that individual animals could no more have their own personalities than could clocks. It's one thing to read that from a long-dead 17th-century philosopher like Descartes, but the thought that an educated professor at a university would teach that to his students in the year 2001 is nothing less than amazing. I'll grant that questions relating to non-human animal thinking are convoluted and complex, but our understanding of the basic principles of how humans learn originated with studies on rats and mice. Single-celled organisms can learn, for heaven's sake, and arguing that animals can't learn is patently absurd. It's equally absurd to deny the obvious differences in behavior among individuals of a complex species like dogs or cats. Pet owners know that their dogs have their own personalities, and many objective scientists report the same phenomenon in wild animals. Even though most animal behavior research is looking for general trends that are only confounded by individual differences, do male and female red-winged blackbirds differ in their responses to territorial intruders? Are older Japanese macaques more or less likely than juveniles to try out new foods? Researchers often comment on compelling individual differences in behavior within many species. Shirley Strum, a well-respected scientist who's been observing olive baboons for several decades, describes one high-status female, Peggy, as a strong, calm, social animal, self-assured yet not pushy, forceful yet not tyrannical. A little later in her book, Almost Human, she describes Peggy's daughter, Thea. Thea was, in fact, a bitch. Her status in the troop was second only to her mother's, and she used it tyrannically. She was unprovokedly aggressive, intimidating other females in situations where Peggy would have calmly quelled the whole matter with a rebuking glance or approached and waited for what she wanted. Steve Suomi is a primatologist who doesn't hesitate to ascribe different personalities to rhesus macaques. It's been the focus of his research for decades. He and his colleagues have found that in these monkeys, stable differences in personality can be seen as early as 1 month of age. Many of the personality differences that he describes in his monkeys conform closely to personality differences in humans and dogs. Some macaques, just like some people and some dogs, are shy in unfamiliar situations or around novel objects, while others can only be described as irritable and quick to fly off the handle. What makes these traits so interesting and so similar to what the research on human personality has found is that while they can appear early in life and remain relatively stable as the animal matures, experiences in early development have a profound effect on how each animal behaves later in life. Shyness, for example, is common in people and dogs, as well as rhesus macaques, and it appears to have both a genetic and an environmental component to it. We've known for many years that shy dogs tend to have a high percentage of shy puppies. John Paul Scott and John L. Fuller's classic research on the genetic basis of dog behavior found that shyness was one of the behavioral traits most affected by genetics. Good breeders know that breeding two shy parents can result in puppies who are extremely shy, although it's rarely as simple as that. More likely, the litter will be a mixed bag of some very shy puppies, some moderately so, and perhaps one or two who aren't shy at all. Researchers have conducted studies on shyness in humans that adroitly separated out genetics and the environment by looking at adopted babies. They found a correlation between shy infants and shy biological mothers, even when the babies were raised by non-shy adoptive parents. The evidence that shyness is partly mediated by genetics in other species is overwhelming. According to Steve Suomi, about 15 to 20% of the populations of several species of primates react more fearfully than others to unfamiliar things. Shyness appears to be what biologists call a conservative trait, meaning that the trait tends to stay in a population and continue to be passed on at similar frequencies. That makes sense, since Suomi also found that shy rhesus macaques are more successful than their bolder peers in some contexts. For example, young male macaques have to leave their natal troop at early maturity and immigrate to another troop. It's a dangerous time for a monkey, and up to half of the males die in the process. The most successful males are the ones who are the largest, and because shy males are more cautious, they strike out on their own at a later age than their peers. Because they are older when they leave, they tend to be larger and are, ironically, more successful than their bolder peers. But researchers have also found strong evidence of environmental influences. Scott and Fuller found that if puppies weren't exposed to humans during their early period of socialization, they grew into adults who were always nervous around new people. Researchers on cat behavior found that kittens from bold parents would react shyly to newcomers if they hadn't interacted with humans when they were young, the most important early interactions being between weeks 3 and 7. Swamy has found that the young of shy rhesus macaque mothers who are genetically predisposed to be shy themselves can nonetheless be relatively outgoing if they are fostered with adoptive females who are highly nurturing and to provide their young with security while encouraging them to interact with others. The evidence is overwhelming that in all complex animals, an individual's personality is the result of the interaction between his or her genetics and the environment. So, in this very important sense, too, we are very much like our dogs, and our dogs are very much like us. Asking if the behavior of either one of us is genetic or environmental is like asking if bread is formed by the ingredients or by the process by which you put them together. If you cooked the eggs before you mixed them with the flour, you wouldn't have what you'd call a loaf of bread, even if you did use all the right ingredients. No matter what influences a dog's and a human's personality, the two can mesh together in sweet harmony or scrape against each other like fingernails on a blackboard. So much of whether a human and a dog get along and whether the dog is perceived as being obedient is based on how their individual natures combine. All relationships are driven by the alchemy of the personalities within it. And that makes just as much sense in relationships between us and our dogs as it does in relationships between us and other people. Most people and most dogs fit into general categories of personality types, from outgoing to reserved, trusting to suspicious, moody to sanguine, active to passive. Most of what seems to make dog lovers happy is to have a dog that has the personality that they cherish, whether it's a slap-happy social butterfly, a feisty Fido who takes on the world with relish, or a quiet, passive couch potato dog who likes curling up in the study and watching old movies as much as you do. What follows are some thoughts about personalities in dogs and some advice about how to look for the dog that you will be happy with and that will be happy with you. I didn't think golden retrievers could bite. Every dog owner whom I know will argue that his or her own dog has a distinct personality. But paradoxically, many people seem to think of all dogs within a breed as behavioral clones. Some people tend to think of a breed designation as if it were a prescription drug, with each dog like a pill in a bottle, each guaranteed to have the same amount of ingredients. I learned how prevalent this belief was when I started seeing aggression cases. What is that dog doing here? I didn't think golden retrievers could bite. I've heard sentences like that 100 times. Just substitute Labrador or Mutt or Cocker Spaniel for the breed that wasn't supposed to have behavioral problems. Dogs can bite if they can open and shut their mouths, and I've seen plenty of individual dogs of docile breeds that have gotten into a lot of trouble with their teeth. Most golden retrievers may be sweet and willing to please, but some individuals within the breed are as hard-headed as hammers. Luke, Pip, and Lassie are all border collies, yet they are as different from one another as I am from other humans with similar genetic backgrounds. Pip is my sleeper border collie, looking a little goofy, a little like Larry Labrador, when in fact she's from pristine sheepdog lineage. Pip's sweet nature has allowed her to rehabilitate almost 100 dogs who were aggressively afraid of other dogs. Time and time again, Pip would lie down 20 feet from barking, snarling dogs and spend as long as she needed to convince them that she meant no harm. She'd ignore their defensive snarls and eventually they'd stop, calm down, and make friends. I've had dozens of owners who got tears in their eyes when they watched their dog play with Pip, the first time in their lives that they'd seen their previously aggressive dog play with another. And then there's Lassie, Luke's daughter, the dog that many people foolishly expect to get, not realizing how rare dogs like her really are. From the day I got her, Lassie has always done everything I've ever asked. Lassie came to me the first time that I called, while she was streaking after a group of dogs at a dead run. That level of obedience usually takes years of training. But with Lassie, it just happened. From day one, she has been one of those remarkable dogs who always knows what you want and, more amazingly, is happy to do it. Dogs like Lassie make dog trainers like me look brilliant when all along we've barely done a thing. That's why I named her Lassie, after the miraculous television dog who always knew what to do when she heard commands like, "Lassie, run down the road into town and get the sheriff and bring him back to the old well about a mile north of here." Lassie is intense, emotional, status-seeking with dogs, but not people, clingy to me and relentlessly obedient. Pip is mellow, submissive, smart, and afraid of conflict or putting herself at risk. She can surprise people by being headstrong. Luke has a noble demeanor, is physically fearless, submissive to people, and a natural leader around dogs, intensely focused, but a team player. They are all border collies, and they share a great deal. They are all athletic. They all quickly learned to run around to the back of sheep and bring them to me, and they all can focus their attention like lasers. Yet they are vastly different from one another, just as you are from others who share your genetic and cultural background. Last week, two of my clients brought in a dog they'd long identified as a mutt. The vet thought maybe a dachshund terrier cross, but the dog was a stellar example of what's affectionately known in this country as a PBGV, or a Petit Basset Griffon Vandine. Although it mattered little in the long run to them, it was fun to show them photos of the rather expensive and rare breed that their former mutt represented. When they learned of his true breed identity, they said, "Well then, next time we get another dog, we're getting a PBGV because he's such a great little dog." I winced internally because, although many PBGVs are indeed delightful dogs, what they adored about this particular dog is his docility and his willingness to learn. That's what they need to look for next. It may well be that certain breeds have a higher proportion of individuals who are like that than others, but it's always smart to focus on the central personality traits that are important as well as just the breed itself. I've seen many disappointed clients in my office who came because the dog they had didn't fit what they expected. When their own dog died, they got another dog of the same breed, expecting to get the same sweet, loving dog that they had before. But while their first dog was docile, the next one was irritable. Or while dog number one was exuberant, dog number two was phlegmatic. Their experience is a good reminder that although choosing the right breed will increase your odds of getting what you want, looking directly at the personality of each dog as an individual will up them even more. The need to pay attention to personality doesn't negate the relevance of the behavioral characteristics of each breed. As a group, each breed has its own characteristic traits, both physical and behavioral. After all, a breed is a group of dogs selected from a small subset of all possible dog genes, genes that provide the blueprint for both the physical and behavioral makeup of a dog. Right now, selection for most breeds is based primarily on skeletal structure, movement, and coat, which results in a tendency for each individual to look a lot like others of the breed. But most breeds were originally bred for function, and there are generalizations you can make about how the dogs within them are going to behave. Most retrievers love to play ball, and most beagles want to put their heads down and sniff out rabbits. So while keeping an appreciation for the unique nature of individuals, it's important to know the behavioral predispositions of the breed of dog that you're considering. If the odds say that 8 out of 10 beagle puppies are going to obsess about tracking rabbits, then you'd better be prepared for a dog that's hard to keep in your backyard without a fence. For example, border collies are terrible pets for most families. Having a typical border collie as a pet is like having a brainy sports car that revs its own engine in the garage if you don't drive it enough. Border collies are smarter than some people, And if they were sports cars, they'd figure out how to open the garage door and drive into your living room to get your attention. You might read the stories about mine, look at the pictures, and think, "That's the perfect dog for me." They are, if you're willing to buy your dog a sheep farm instead of a cheaper toy, if you think it's fun to go on long walks in blizzard conditions, and if you're planning on becoming a professional dog trainer. Most border collies don't just need physical exercise. They need mental exercise as well. So if you're too busy to bring a new child into your household, don't get a border collie. The idea of a smart dog like a border collie is attractive to a lot of people. But when people tell me that their dog is especially smart, I usually say, "What a shame." Smart dogs learn how to get in the garbage, how to play you off against your husband, and how to open the cabinet door that you thought you'd padlocked. They are also enthusiastic. "Hi, wow, it's morning. Isn't that great? Hey, did the cows get out? What? It's 5 in the morning? I know, it's late." Of course, as I said earlier in the section, every border collie is different. Luke and his daughter are far more enthusiastic than their cousin Pip, who is the most mellow border collie I've ever known. But people would do well to carefully research the typical behavior of the breed in which they're interested before they bring a dog of that breed into their home. A dear friend of mine wanted a dog that would stay around her house in the country and not bother her chickens. Before I knew it, she had adopted 2 husky puppies from the same litter. The pups are only 5 months old now, and the chicken population, I'm sorry to say, is declining at an alarming rate. Dogs don't read the books. Both personality and general breed characteristics are important when deciding on a dog, but there's a vital caveat to keep in mind when you're reading about breed characteristics. Dogs don't read the written breed descriptions. The world is full of border collies that won't herd, Doberman pincers that hide behind your skirts, and pushy status-seeking retrievers. Every dog is different, because each dog's behavior is the result of a unique combination of genes and the environment. There'll never be another Luke, just as there'll never be another you. That's the benefit of sexual reproduction. Sex causes all kinds of problems, not just to us humans, but it guarantees that the genes of 2 individuals are mixed and matched such that each of the offspring is unique. That's why even the best of breeders can't predict how their puppies will turn out. With each breeding, a breeder is playing the odds that a particular mating will produce the desired breed characteristics and personality. But as we all know, good odds aren't guarantees about how any one event will turn out. If you look at 100 dogs of a given breed, say 100 standard poodles, most of them will be about the same size and height and will be athletic, brilliant, and joyful. But some of them, a smaller number, will be shorter or taller, or maybe not quite so smart, or perhaps clingy and submissive. It's like the odds in horse racing. Good odds mean that if your horse ran 10 races, he might win 7 of them, but it doesn't tell you whether the next race will be one of the 7 that he wins or one of the 3 that he loses. The right stuff. Besides being aware of the behavioral tendencies of the breed in which you're interested, you'll also want to know the specific qualities the breeder admires. The traits that you want in a dog might not be the same ones that a breeder wants. Right now, most breeders get rewarded for breeding dogs that win confirmation shows or field trials, not for breeding sweet, docile dogs that you can trust with your family. The blue ribbons and the attention in the dog world are mostly focused on physical traits like coat condition or the right shoulder angle and behavioral traits like confidence and drive. Confirmation judges favor dogs that show well, meaning that the dogs are confident and assertive and stride around the ring as if they owned it. Breeders who compete with their hunting dogs in field trials need dogs with phenomenal drive and stamina who aren't stopped by freezing water or thorn bushes. People who need great working livestock dogs need dogs who are capable of working a 12-hour day in a snowstorm. But none of these qualities is what most pet owners need in their family dog. Confident, assertive dogs may look great in the show ring, but they can be too much to handle in a house with three kids under the age of 7. Retrievers who won't give up no matter what will use their drive and stamina to find yet another way to get at the garbage. Herding dogs who are capable of working 12 hours a day turn into maniacs when their daily exercise consists of a half-hour leash walk. Although a lot of breeders care deeply about disposition, the fact of the matter is that they get little tangible reinforcement for breeding sweet, docile dogs. They get money, ribbons, and public recognition for breeding dogs who match the written breed standard, who sail around show rings or who can perform hunting, retriever, or herding tasks, but not for breeding dogs who are easy to train and good with children. Pet quality dogs are often sold for less money than show quality dogs, as if somehow a dog who is going to make a family's life either heaven or hell is of less value than one who wins some blue ribbons at a competition. Pet quality dogs are usually just as healthy as show quality dogs, but their coat isn't the right color or their muzzle is too snippy to win blue ribbons, so they are sold as family pets. What matters most, I think, to those of us who have dogs living in our homes as companions is that our dogs are healthy and that they don't hurt anybody. Some breeders argue that their dogs could never compete in dog shows if they weren't well-tempered, but sad to say, I've seen lots of dogs with long dog show histories who may be polite at dog shows but aren't polite at home. Still, there are many breeders out there for whom a good disposition is their most important breeding criterion, but they don't get a lot of support or credit for it, even though we know that docility can be influenced by careful breeding. Remember the experiment on docility in foxes? I know breeders of herding dogs who breed for useful farm dogs who can bite a bull on the nose when they need to, but who would turn inside out before they snapped at a child. I know confirmation breeders who want to win Westminster, but who would never breed a dog they wouldn't trust with their grandchildren. They don't get blue ribbons or prize money or acknowledgement on national TV for it. That's reserved for dogs with a balanced stride and a good body. Maybe someday we'll have a star-studded night of glitz and glamour that celebrates breeders who produce sweet, docile dogs. But for now, prospective dog owners have to use criteria other than dog shows and competitions to be sure that they're getting a good family pet. Of course, a dog's behavior is only partly influenced by her genetics. The environment in which she grows up and lives has a profound effect on whether or not a dog will bite. Almost all dogs can be made to bite, and I've seen some pathetic cases of truly good dogs who were given no other alternative. But I've seen just as many dogs given good starts in life who lived with good people and yet still terrorized the family with their teeth. My office has seen at least 30 puppies who snarled and bit at your face when they were just 8 or 9 weeks old. I'm not talking about puppies who didn't know how to be polite with their mouths and got a little nippy in play. I'm talking about puppies whose eyes go hard while they stare straight at you and who bring the corners of their mouth forward in an offensive pucker just before they try to hurt you. It's chilling when you see an animal that young act with such intensity. And although some of these dogs can be handled so that they grow up to be safe in some contexts, they're hardly the dog that most people want to bring home. No matter what you as a breeder or a puppy buyer do, you can't guarantee that the dog that you bred or bought or have now will never bite. It's just not possible. A dog's behavior is such a complicated interplay of so many things that it's impossible to make solid predictions. What you can do, however, is get the odds on your side. I've seen scores of people in my office who said, "I don't know what the disposition of my dog's mother or father was. I couldn't get near them because they were barking and snarling." Oh dear. May I suggest that the barking and snarling might provide a clue? Puppy buyers need to pay careful attention to the behavior of the parents and avoid getting a puppy from parent dogs who aren't polite. The behavior of the parents will tell you a lot more about the eventual disposition of a puppy than the behavior of a 7-week-old puppy will. If you can't pet the mother, The sweet little pup that you're about to take home may not let your visitors in the house once she's an adult. Of course, as I said earlier, there's no guarantee that the pups will act like their parents or grandparents. But why not get the odds on your side? One of the ways to do that is to ask the breeder very specific questions about the behavior of the pup's parents and grandparents. What would the father of the pups do if someone barged into the house at night? You may like the idea of a protective dog, but don't forget that the person barging in may be a firefighter trying to rescue your child. What if a young child tried to take a real bone away from the pup's mother? Many breeders won't know what would happen in that context, because they wouldn't allow that situation to occur. But how they answer the question can say a lot about what level of docility they expect from a dog. Some breeders will tell you that they would never expect a dog to tolerate such a violation, while others will answer that their dogs wouldn't even blink, and that their 5-year-old nephew did that very thing last night, and Queenie responded by licking his face. When you are talking to either the breeder of the puppies or the former owner of the adult dog, there are a lot more questions to ask. Does the dog allow people to pull burrs out of her tail? If you're looking at a little puppy, do the dam and the sire allow grooming and handling? How about trimming their nails? Taking away their favorite toys? How are they at the vet's? How about with other dogs, both familiar and unfamiliar ones? Do they bark out the window for a few seconds when visitors arrive? Or do they bark nonstop for 10 minutes? Have they ever growled, shown their teeth, snapped, nipped, or bitten anyone for any reason? Is the dog different with unfamiliar people than he is with familiar people? It's important to ask very specific questions, not general ones like, are the parents friendly? Friendly can mean a lot of things. I've met hundreds of dogs that people described as the sweetest, most loving dogs you could imagine. All of these dogs may have bitten numerous times, but they still had wonderful dispositions, according to the owners. And that was true in one sense, because the dogs might have been wonderful with the family, cuddling on the couch each night with the teenage daughter, but let a stranger try to enter the house, even a welcome guest, and watch out. So, in this case, the dog was friendly to familiar people, but not to unfamiliar ones. That's why the questions need to be so specific. Just as with people, the behavior of dogs varies depending on the context. And you need to ask about a dog's behavior in as many different situations as you can imagine to get a clear idea of who he really is. After all, Jeffrey Dahmer was nice all day long at the chocolate factory. If you're asking about a young dog, remember that age has an important effect on behavior. Just like humans, most dogs behave differently when they're mature than when they're younger. Just because an adolescent dog hides behind your legs when visitors come doesn't mean that he will when he's 3 years old. By then, he might have gotten over his fears, or he might be more inclined to act on them and go after your guests with his teeth. How about exercise? Again, be sure to be specific, because exercise means different things to different people. 2 short leash walks a day don't even get a Welsh Corgi warmed up. A year-old Labrador Retriever can barely think until he's had a good long session of running 2 or 3 times a day. Young Australian cattle dogs can no more sit still for hours than a 5-year-old boy can. The list of questions goes on and on. Develop your own list based on what is important to you. If you're sound sensitive, you probably don't want a dog that barks a lot, while other people wouldn't mind at all. Some dogs require extensive grooming, and for some people, that's a problem. I can barely keep my own hair brushed, so I'd be a disastrous owner for a Lhasa Apso. So if you're looking for a dog, be thoughtful about what you want. There's great value in writing it down because it focuses your attention on what's important. And for those of us who already have a dog or dogs, it's useful to ask the same questions and get a clear evaluation of whom you're living with. Be a field researcher in your own living room and write down an objective description of your dog as an individual. You might be surprised at what you come up with. Pretty is as pretty does. A few years ago, I got a call from a dairy farmer who wanted a good working dog, and had heard that I bred border collies. "You got any dogs with a brown spot on their ear?" I did have a litter of puppies from good working parents, so I asked him what he was looking for.
"I don't need any fancy dog. I just need a dog who'll do the chores, sort out the heifers, back off the bull, protect the farm when we're gone, and be real good and gentle with my grandchildren. I had a good dog like that before, but he died. He had a brown spot on his ear, so I'm looking for another one just like him."
This is the place in a Dave Barry column where he'd say, "I'm not making this up." Try as I might, I couldn't convince the caller that although my puppies had no brown spots on their ears, they had the potential of being fine working dogs who were also good with kids. Apparently, the caller had had a wonderful dog, the only one he'd ever had with a brown spot on his ear, and he figured that the brown spot was the key to his good disposition. Lest you start feeling a bit smug about the beliefs of an old, seemingly ignorant farmer, keep in mind that many of the people whom I see, including PhDs and physicians, put a tremendous value on what a dog looks like. For years, I asked all the dog owners who came into my office why it was that they picked the pup that they did when they had an entire litter from which to choose. The first criterion was sex, with most people strongly wanting one or the other. But after sorting out which sex they wanted, about 85% of them picked their dog based on looks rather than behavior. They liked the one with more white on him or the one marked most like their previous dog. They didn't want the pup with one blue eye, or they only wanted the one with one blue eye. They liked long hair rather than short, or short hair rather than long, droopy ears rather than prick ears, or black noses instead of pink ones. Some physical features are universally attractive. Symmetry, for example. But each of us has our own special reaction to the looks of different dogs. A survey of the people at the Central Office of Dogs Best Friend Limited illustrates the tendency of all of us to be attracted to different kinds of dogs. Amy Moore, the training director, is a sucker for fluffy dogs, especially white ones. The office manager, Denise Swedland, may think white and fluffy is cute, but cream-colored golden retrievers melt her heart. Jackie Boland, office assistant, can't resist short-haired Labrador retrievers. And Karen London, PhD, applied animal behaviorist, likes dogs who look playful and youthful. We all may favor different types of looks, but looks play no small role in our attraction to dogs. Our obsession with looks is not surprising, I suppose, when you consider what a visual species we are and that looks are staggeringly important in our interactions with people. Attractive people are more likely to be hired, are more likely to get raises, are more likely to get away with shoplifting, and are judged to be more intelligent than those who are less attractive. With a legacy like that, no wonder we care so much about what our dogs look like. But being seduced by good looks can get puppy buyers in trouble, just as it gets people in trouble when they are shopping for a prospective mate. Pretty figures and handsome faces may have a powerful effect on us in the beginning of a relationship, but they don't keep us happy in the long term. When you have to take a bone out of your dog's mouth, you're not going to care much if her ears are cute. "Pretty is as pretty does" applies just as readily to our dogs as it does to people. Remember when that good-looking date turned out to be a jerk? Picking the prettiest puppy can have the same result. So look more carefully at the plain black dog that everyone else ignores. He just might be the best one. But he never does that at home. For some reason, we humans are surprised when our dogs act differently in one context than another. "Gosh, he's always been so good with dogs," says the owner of the Spaniel Akita mix that got into a dogfight at her neighbor's house. But it turns out that the dog has only been around dogs that he knows, not ones that he's never met before. Meeting a new, unfamiliar dog at the neighbor's is going to bring out a different dog than the one sharing the rug with the Cocker Spaniel with which he grew up. Just as with humans, changes in the environment affect how your dog behaves. A dog who's hot and frustrated at the pet food store isn't going to react the same as a dog who's contented and relaxed in the backyard. We all know that people behave differently in different environments,
You may be one person on a cool walk in the spring countryside, and an altogether different one on a hot, humid day in a traffic jam. But for some reason, we don't transfer this knowledge to our dogs. Different environments bring out different aspects of your dog, and you don't really know your dog until you've seen her in a variety of situations. This explains why different members of the family will disagree with one another in my office about how their dog behaves. "He does not," a woman will say, frustrated that her husband is describing something that her dog has never done in his life. Ah, but her dog probably has done it, no matter what it is, just not in her presence. Just as you and I have done things in one context that we'd never do in another, it's common for dogs to behave differently in different places and with different people. Rocky might growl at home to his female human, but not to his male human. Ginger may retrieve tennis balls in the living room, but not in the backyard. Duke may be a sweetie at the vet clinic, but rude and demanding at home. So don't get in a fight with your spouse about her bogus descriptions of your dog's behavior. She just might be describing something that happens when you're not there to see it. Dog trainers and veterinarians would also do well to give their fellow humans more credit. I see an amazing number of frustrated dog owners who plaintively say, "No one will believe me, but honest, I swear to you, he looks right in my eyes and growls at me." I've had clients, usually women, who showed me their scars and bruises, all the results of dog bites, with a kind of victorious relief because, finally, they had evidence of what they'd been complaining about for months. Meanwhile, in my office, their dog is doing a brilliant impersonation of a perfect pet. But I always make it clear to them that dogs behave differently in different places, and that I have no trouble imagining the dog who's a big, goofy lover boy in my office being different at home. Dogs not only behave differently in dissimilar environments, but they behave differently in the same environment at different times of the day. This, too, seems inexplicable to many dog owners. How could he be so good this morning and so grumpy last night? Probably for the same reason that you, too, are sweet one minute and grumpy the next. Few of us react exactly the same to each of life's irritations. Last week, happy and relaxed from a lovely weekend, I broke one of my favorite bowls and shrugged it off in an instant. A few days later, exhausted from a tiring and stress-filled week, I dropped a glass that I care little about and yelled an epithet so loudly that my dogs left the room. It's so common for us to have good days and bad days that humans who are always patient and benevolent stand out like saints. That kind of consistency is as rare among dogs as it is among people. Just like us, dogs can get tired, frustrated, hungry, or irritated. And just like us, they don't respond the same from minute to minute. The behavior of complex mammals is influenced by a daunting number of factors, from blood sugar levels to serotonin and dopamine reuptake mechanisms in the brain to conditioned responses to stressful encounters with others. So do your dog a favor, and don't get confused by her flexibility of responses. She'll be much better off if you spend your energy asking yourself what it was specifically that caused her to act in a way that surprised or disappointed you, rather than being perplexed that her behavior varies. This natural tendency to react differently at different times and in different places explains a tremendous amount of what looks like disobedience. Just as actors tend to forget lines when they first put on their costumes, our dogs forget their lessons when we ask them to do things in new contexts. That's why professional dog trainers spend so much time proofing their dogs, ensuring that the dog is comfortable in a new environment before they put too much pressure on her to perform. Your dog will be grateful if you follow their lead. Sit in the kitchen before dinner isn't the same as sit at the front door with visitors outside. Sit pretty in the TV room doesn't automatically transfer to sit pretty in the vet's office. So expect your dog to need help in new environments and give her the same permission that you give yourself. To need time to adapt to new environments and to practice a skill in the context in which you'll be using it. Your dog will thank you for it, I promise. Perhaps one of the kindest things that you can do for your dog is to understand that, just like us humans, every dog has both a unique nature and a bevy of characteristics that he shares with others, and that this bedrock foundation of personality is influenced each second by internal and external factors that impinge upon him throughout the day. Every dog is indeed special, and he deserves a human who gives him permission to be who he is, whether it's sweet and shy or bold and cocky. It's not fair to expect him to be perfect, although, like us, some may be a lot closer than others. I don't want you to get the impression that Luke is perfect, because he's not. In his youth, he was too pushy with sheep, lacking the finesse that he's gained through experience and maturity. He has been known to lose his temper with sheep, as he did when we were in the lead in a big herding dog trial. We were at the end of the best run of our lives and had all the sheep but one in the pen. If we could just get them all inside and I could close the gate within the next 2 minutes, we'd win the trial. My heart was beating so loudly I could hear it, but the crowd was stone quiet in anticipation of what would happen next. 4 times in a row, a bulky ewe leapt away from the pen just when it appeared she was about to go in. The crowd groaned in shared disappointment each time that she bolted, and each time my hot, tired dog gathered her up and herded her back to the mouth of the pen. Again, she dashed away, but this time, Luke pinned back his ears and bit her. It was not an appropriate nip to round her back up. It was an irritated cheater bite to her back leg. He nipped once and let go immediately, but he'd clearly had it with her foolishness. Anyone who's ever seriously worked a dog on sheep knew that Luke was just frustrated. The judge certainly knew and said appropriately enough, "Thank you," which is herding trial lingo for, "Please leave the course now. You and your dog are disqualified." I could have been mad at Luke, I suppose, because if he hadn't lost his temper, we could have won the trial. But all of us who raise sheep understood how he felt. We've all had our patience stretched thin trying to move sheep in the heat of summer and the stinging cold of winter, running out of time, desperate now to get the sheep out of the alfalfa, where they'll die of bloat, or away from the ram who jumped the fence. But you don't need to raise sheep to understand losing your temper. Luke is good and noble and brave, but on occasion, he can lose his temper around sheep. I would like to be good and noble and brave too, but that's not for me to say. I can lose my temper, though. Maybe that's another reason Luke and I get along so well.